From Luke chapter 12, starting at verse 49, and you'll find that on page 1050 in the church Bibles. That's page 1050, Luke chapter 12, beginning at verse 49. I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For from now on, in one house, there will be five divided, three against two, and two against three. They will be divided, father against son, and son against father, mother against daughter, and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. He also said to the crowds, when you see a cloud rising in the west, you say at once, a shower is coming, and so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say, there will be scorching heat. And it happens. You hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? And why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? As you go with your accuser before the magistrate, make an effort to settle with him on the way, lest he drag you to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and the officer put you in prison. I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the very last penny.
Thank you. Do you keep that passage open in front of you? Keep that passage open in front of you. You'll find on the inside of your song sheets, on the back of the notice sheet, an outline of where we'll be going this morning. Well, some people say that religion is the cause of all the conflict in the world, don't they? And to a certain extent, you can see why people would say that, that religion is the cause of all the conflict in the world. What do people who say that point to? Well, the Crusades, of course, Christian against Muslim. Northern Ireland during the Troubles, Protestant against Catholic. Iraq at the moment, Sunni versus Shia. The problems in Kashmir, Hindu versus Muslim. And of course, it's very popular, even trendy at the moment, to blame right-wing Christians in America for all sorts of things. The Iraq War, for instance, was all their fault, as I learnt this week on TV, is global warming. These religious people, with all their funny ideas and their sacred texts, they're all to blame. Perhaps Richard Dawkins and the other celebrity atheists are right, and we should ban religion or something. And then, as John Lennon's classic song Imagine put it, with no religion, we'd have all the people living life in peace. Woohoo. Thank you. Well, I think that's a naive vision, really, isn't it? Not just John Lennon's song, but all of that. Because even if we could pin down some conflict to a particular religious cause, there's usually a dozen other things going on underneath the surface which on their own would be sufficient for a bloodbath. Getting rid of religion wouldn't eliminate people's greed, envy, ambition, rivalry, hatred, stubbornness, and lust for power. I've noticed, maybe you have too, that even people without a religion seem to be infected with those conflict-causing traits. But, you know, perhaps religion should just tone it down a bit. A lady, not somebody here, but a lady said to me recently that she liked Jesus because he was all about peace and brotherhood. But she didn't like the particular speaker that we were listening to together because he emphasized people's differences in religion, different beliefs, as if there was only one way or something. You should have talked more like Jesus, she said, and been more concerned with peace. I thought a bit about what she was saying. After all, Jesus is called in the Bible, isn't he? The Prince of Peace. And when he was born, it's here in Luke's Gospel, chapter 2, a choir of angels announced, "Glory to God in the highest, and peace on earth." Peace. And isn't the peace of God supposed to guard our hearts and our minds, according to the Bible? Isn't that right? Then as I was talking to this lady, I remembered this passage that we come to today in our series of sermons on Luke's Gospel. And when I showed it to her, I grabbed a Bible, I showed her this verse, she didn't have a clue what to do with it, except to ignore it. What does Jesus say? Luke 12, verse 51. "Do you think that I have come to bring peace on earth?" says Jesus. "No, I tell you, but rather division." I don't think she'd heard it before. You can see why, can't you? It's not going to be one of the top 10 Christmas carol service texts, is it? Maybe it would be a good one. But it does jar a bit with what we expect of Jesus, doesn't it? I mean, Jesus came to save us. Jesus came to love us. Isn't that the message he came to bring? "No, I tell you, but rather division." Now, I really dislike confrontation. I think most right-thinking people do, don't they? To my mind, there's nothing better than when we all get on well with each other without arguments and fights and petty squabbles. Friction in relationships is a horrible thing. Keeps me awake at night. Gives me a headache and an anxious twist in my stomach. So what does Jesus mean that he came to bring division? I don't like violence either, do you? I hate war and killing, rape and pillage. I abhor the fact that I have to censor out parts of the 7 o'clock news so the kids don't see countless images of global conflict and brutal carnage with their bedtime milk. Is Jesus saying here that all that is okay? Is he saying the Crusaders were right? That might makes right? That aggression against the infidels is justified and sanctioned? That's what Richard Dawkins thinks religion is all about. Breeding violence and cruelty and bigotry and conflict. And when Jesus says, "I came to bring division," that's what many people think he means. Well, does he? Does he mean that? Well, in this series on understanding Jesus, today we will discover that he is less peaceful than we anticipate, as you'll see from the heading on the top of the handout. If we think that Jesus is a flower power hippie in sandals come to arrange a global group hug, well, what he says today should make us think again. But equally, if we think that this saying about division is a mandate for religiously inspired hatred or murder, then we're also quite, quite wrong. Jesus is neither a wishy-washy liberal or an angry fundamentalist. We're looking at verses 49 to 59 today, to the end of the chapter. Three little paragraphs. They're all seemingly disconnected from each other, aren't they? So first there's something about division, then something about the weather, then something about debtor's prison and paying the last penny. Well, what do they all have in common, these three paragraphs? Why have I put them all together? Well, I think that the thread that stitches these paragraphs together is the theme that we've been seeing over the past few weeks in Luke chapter 12. Judgment Day is coming. Judgment Day is coming. We saw that back in the story of the rich fool. So in chapter 12, verse 20, at the top left-hand corner of the page, page 1050, we heard God say to the man, "This night your soul is required of you." And then further down in verse 32, we heard about God's coming kingdom and a future world where true wealth can be found. And then in last week's passage, verse 40, we're told to be ready, for the Son of Man, the Judge, is coming unexpectedly. You see, the common thread through all of this so far is Judgment Day is coming. Jesus is the Judge. And on the other side of that great and dreadful day, there is a new and perfect world of peace and harmony and glory for us to enjoy. Or there's a less pleasant and desirable condition, depending on how we react now to the Judge. And today's passage, these three paragraphs, fits in with that theme that we've seen so far. Jesus reminds us that Judgment Day is coming. But with his arrival, the great separation that will happen on that day has already started to come about. Like a magnet, Jesus will attract some and repel others. This should make us realize that final judgment is just on the horizon and encourage us to sort things out with Jesus as soon as we can. Well, that's where we're going. Let's look at it a bit more closely, bit by bit. First, let's take a look at verse 49. Verse 49, Luke chapter 12. Jesus says, "I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it is accomplished." Jesus has come to set the world ablaze, he says. Like the angels in Revelation chapter 8, he's come to throw fire down on the earth in judgment. And he wants to get on with it, doesn't he? He wishes it was already kindled, he says. Because Judgment Day stands between us and that perfect new creation that he's planned. And Judgment Day must come first. But there's something else that has to happen even before that. Judgment Day, in which Jesus will play the part of the judge, cannot happen, he says, until he has been baptized. Now that's a bit confusing at first, because if you know Luke's gospel, hasn't Jesus already been baptized by John the Baptist back in chapter 3 of this book? Well, that's right. So what he's referring to here must be something else, a different kind of baptism. He's not talking about a baptism with water, but a baptism of fire, as it were. His baptism into death. His submergence through the pain of the cross and the separation of his body and soul into death. Because before Jesus can ascend to heaven and take his place at the right hand of God again, he must die for the sins of the world. Before he becomes the judge of the world, he must be judged and punished in our place. And clearly he wants to get on with this baptism of fire, doesn't he? "I wish Judgment Day was already here," he says. "I'm distressed until my baptism of fire is over with." He's longing for the plan of God to be fulfilled, the plan laid long ago from before the world began. The plan that will see him crowned as king over the whole earth, reigning as the Prince of Peace over harmonious and united people. That is the end point that Jesus is longing for. But until that blessed state can come about, there will be division and difficulty and confrontation. Verse 51. "Do you think I've come to bring peace on the earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. From now on, in one house there will be five divided, three against two and two against three. They will be divided." See, one day in the kingdom of glory, there will be peace. Everyone will acknowledge the rule of Christ, as every knee must bow. But until that day, Jesus will be the cause of division. How people react to him will cause arguments and strife. There'll be disagreements, even within the closest families, it seems, as people respond differently to Jesus and his claim to be king over them. He illustrates it with a family of five. I think it's a dad, a mum, a son, a daughter, and a mother-in-law. A bit like how it was this weekend when my family and I went up to see my mum for a few days and stayed at hers. The five of us. Or it could be a slightly different family makeup. It could be that the daughter-in-law there, in Jesus' example, is the son's wife, who's come to live with the other four. Something like that. Now, of course, that in and of itself doesn't sound like a recipe for family disaster, does it? Having your mother-in-law living with you. But it wasn't at all unusual in those days for a wider family to live together with what we call the nuclear family unit. But you notice in Jesus' example that what causes the family divisions here is not arguments about who does the washing up and who gets to sleep on the sofa. The divisive factor is Jesus. Even within this closely knit family, some will respond differently to Jesus. Some will embrace him and follow him as their Lord. Others will be skeptical, hostile even, to his claims over their lives. I think most of us here are all too aware what this is like, aren't we? Rare is the family which enjoys complete agreement and harmony on this subject. Just think about my own family. My father and my brother, they're not Christians, with varying levels of hostility. There are others here who might have two or even three different religions represented in their wider family. And you can see this division very clearly whenever Jesus is even mentioned in your household. He caused division in his own day as well, didn't he? In the previous chapter of Luke's Gospel, we hear about some people who tried to provoke him and catch him out. We just need to look on the other side of the page, chapter 13, verse 14. We see there a man who is indignant, it says, indignant with Jesus for something. Over the page in verse 31, we hear of a plot to kill him. And all the while, other people are believing and hearing him and following him gladly. People are divided over Jesus. So we shouldn't be surprised at that. We shouldn't be discouraged or disappointed if the whole world haven't become Christians in the last 2,000 years. It doesn't prove, as some would like it to prove, that Jesus can't be God, because, oh, surely if he was God, then everyone would believe in him, wouldn't they? No, says Jesus. Jesus himself says, I will always be the cause of arguments. Two against three and three against two. So this division that he's talking about here, it's not something that we need to stir up or encourage. He's not calling us here, is he, to go around killing the infidel or enslaving unbelievers. That hardly fits in with what he said in Luke chapter 6 about loving even our enemies and doing good to those who hate us. No, Jesus is not stirring up hatred, but warning us that division and confrontation will be inevitable this side of Judgment Day. And we need to be prepared for that when we follow him. There will be a cost in personal terms when we choose to follow Jesus. A cost in our personal relationships. Becoming a Christian is not the path to choose if we're looking to get on with everybody and just slide harmoniously through life. It will give us new priorities, new agendas, new ideals, new pleasures. And these will inevitably clash with the standards and desires of people that we know and love who don't follow Jesus. Of course, when that happens, the temptation is just to go along with the ways of the world, the ways of the rest of my family, for the sake of an easy life, for the sake of peace and quiet and concord. But Jesus has already told us here that what matters is not how comfortable we are in this transient world, but whether we're prepared for the next. And if we abandon Jesus now, we'll miss out on that world to come. So even if it does mean difficulty and distress, which, of course, Jesus hates as much as we do, even if it means we can't go along with the rest of our family or agree with our friends, sticking with Jesus, it's our only option. It won't be all flowers and fluffiness now. For the Lord himself, of course, it meant persecution and crucifixion. But what he longed for, and what we all long for, is a time when all things in heaven and on earth will be brought together under Jesus Christ in peace in that new creation. Well, when will that be? When's it going to happen? Of course, the timing of Judgment Day has always been a bit of an issue. Old Mother Shipton is reputed to have said something like, "The end of the world shall surely come in the year 2021. Others rely less on the disturbed ramblings of old witches and are looking out for signs of the end. But in the next little section here, Jesus says that people are not generally very good at reading the signs of the times, even if they are old Mother Shipton. Let's look again at verse 54. Jesus said to the crowds, "When you see a cloud rising in the west, you say at once, 'A shower is coming.' And so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say, 'There will be scorching heat.' And it happens. You hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time?" Weathermen. You know, weathermen, they usually get it right, don't they? The weathermen. I know there's that famous example when Michael Fish announced on the BBC just before a huge storm that anybody who was worried about a hurricane was rather silly. But normally, weather forecasters don't need to look quite so sheepish the day after. They've got it down to a fine art. Red sky at night, shepherd's delight. Well, says Jesus, that's all very well. But if you claim to be clever and you can't see what's going on right in front of your face, then you're as silly as Michael Fish supposedly was in 1987. There's a storm coming. "Can't you see?" says Jesus. "Can't you see what's right in front of you?" I guess all they could see in front of them was a Galilean carpenter with his fishing buddies tagging along. But Jesus wanted them to look a bit deeper than that, to see what was happening all around him and read the signs. Judgment Day was coming. The judge is here. People were dividing for him and against him. He was doing incredible miracles. Just in the last few chapters of this book alone, he's been casting out demons. He's fed 5,000 people with a few loaves and fish. He's calmed the storm. In the next few chapters after this, he'll heal people again with just a word. Shouldn't that have made people sit up and think, at least? Shouldn't it have given people pause for thought about who this man could be? But it didn't, always. All some people saw in Jesus was a con man, or someone trying to whip up popular support. The established authorities took him for somebody threatening their hold on power. They could read the popular mood, but they couldn't read Jesus. They couldn't see that this was the judge of all the worlds, coming ahead of time before the judgment day to suss things out and to save his people. And Jesus rebukes them here for not being able to see it. For not being able to see that now is the time for decision and action regarding Jesus. To read the signs that here is someone special. And make the most of the time that we have to assess him and respond to him. Judgment Day is coming. We can read the markets. People around here are very good at that. We can read the markets. We can predict what might happen in the football or in Big Brother. With a bit of effort, we can even interpret the political signals coming from the government. But Jesus' tone here is quite harsh, isn't it? He calls them, verse 56, you hypocrites. He's saying, some people won't or can't invest the same level of ingenuity and skill in discerning who he is. Like many of us today, the people of Jesus' day thought that they knew who Jesus was. So they just got on with more important things, like talking about the weather, apparently. How very English. And Jesus is saying to them, as he says to us, can't you see? Can't you see who I am, he says. Can't you work out from what I've said and what I've done and how people are reacting to me? And if though we're ever so good at working through other problems and issues at work or at home, if we can't see that Judgment Day is coming, his rebuke here applies to us as well. We're hypocrites, he says, and not as clever as we think we are. So he says he's not come to bring peace yet. Can you see? And now finally, let's look at the last point that Jesus makes in this chapter. And the essence of it is, since Judgment Day is coming, it's upon us, we need to get sorted with the judge. Let's look finally at verses 57 to 59 together. And why do you not judge for yourselves what is right, he says. As you go with your accuser before the magistrate, make an effort to settle with him on the way, lest he drag you to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and the officer put you in prison. I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the very last penny. Now this fits in quite snugly, actually, with the flow of the passage as a whole. Jesus warns us, to start with, that people will divide around him. We should be able to see that happening all around us, even before we get to Judgment Day. But since Judgment Day is coming, the theme of this chapter, we have to make a choice now. Will we get sorted with Jesus before then? Now, to some, these words may sound familiar. In Matthew's Gospel, near the beginning, Jesus says something similar to what he says in these verses, but in a different context. In Matthew, the point is more to do with sorting out our relationships with other people. The context is our horizontal relationships with other people and getting them right. If it was the same sort of thing here, then I guess it might go back to that bit about being divided from people. So he could be encouraging us that even if we do argue and are divided against each other because of him, we should make sure that we sort it out before it gets to a court of law. But I don't think that meaning really fits very well here. It jars a little bit, because here the context is very different. He's using the same illustration as he uses in Matthew, but with a different purpose. He's urging us here to get sorted vertically before we're dragged to the judge and thrown in prison. In the context of the last few verses, and the context of this chapter as a whole, we should be able to see that judgment day is coming. And now Jesus is saying it's very important for us to settle things in advance of that day. Because once it gets to the judge, it's too late. It's too late. Once we stand before the throne of God on judgment day, the time for making up has gone. Now is the day to sort it out. Today is the day to settle our accounts with Jesus. What happens to us in the next life is what's important, as we've been seeing over these last few weeks. We have an opportunity now to make arrangements in advance of that day. But that opportunity won't last forever. As you go with your accuser before the magistrate, make an effort to settle with him on the way. Before judgment day arrives, get your act together, he says. Because if we don't, there's a certain definite chain of events to follow. He will drag us to the judge, the judge will hand us over to the officer, and the officer will throw us into prison. And we will never get out. We will never get out. Our debt before God is infinite. Note, by the way, there's quite an interesting little detail here in the text. No time is spent in Jesus' little illustration here deliberating about our guilt or innocence. Jesus doesn't even pause to mention the handing down of the verdict on Judgment Day as if it was the dramatic moment and could go either way. No, Jesus just goes straight from court appearance to sentencing. He simply presumes our guilt before God on Judgment Day. Why shouldn't he? There's a certain inevitability about it here. Every one of us will be judged. Murderers, warmongers, terrorists, oh yes. All those who disturb the peace of the world. But every one of us, too. We're all destined to die once and after that to face judgment. That's the road we're on, says Jesus. And as you go with your accuser before the magistrate, make every effort to settle with him on the way. Our accuser is God, the one who knows every thought of our hearts, who sees every act of our will, who hears every word that we utter. He also will be our judge. Now, as I walk along life's road, I can avoid him. I've done it often enough in my own life. I can wriggle out of God's grasp, ignore his wistful glances. I can push him aside, ever so politely, of course, and refuse to listen to his offers of peace and reconciliation. But we're on our way to Judgment Day. No way to avoid it. On my way to Judgment Day, where it will be too late. If only I could be reconciled to him before we get to the heavenly courtroom. If only there was a way to escape the penalty that my sinful rebellion against him deserves. Well, there is a way. And it involves baptism. Not my baptism. Not being splashed with a bit of water, as if that could sort out a lifetime of falling short and going too far. No, the baptism which can save us is the baptism of Jesus, mentioned in verse 50. His baptism of fire in the agonies of death. Because as Jesus plunges into the cold, dark depths of death, he suffers the punishment that my sins deserve, and the punishment deserved by all those who are joined to him, all who cling to him and cleave to him, no matter what trouble it brings them in this short and transitory life. Because all of us who are divided from our families and friends because of our commitment to Jesus are joined with Jesus inseparably. Our sin has been dealt with once and for all, dead and gone, when Jesus is crucified, died, and was buried. There's nothing more to pay. Nothing more to pay. The debt, every penny of the debt, is taken by the bailiffs at the gates of hell from Jesus. So that at the final audit, not the slightest penny will I owe if I stand with Jesus. If we sort it out beforehand, he can pay for me. But some people always insist on paying debts themselves, don't they? And they will have their wish. If we won't accept this kind of help from Jesus, don't want to be a charity case and settle with him on the road to Judgment Day, we can keep our heads high and proud all the way to a prison cell in hell. And we can be baptized in the blackest darkness forever. But Jesus says, come on, come. Let's sort it out now. Let's just sort it out so it doesn't come to that. Come to me to have peace that will last forever. It might mean trouble for you now, but in the long run, Judgment Day is coming. Let's pray. A moment of quiet as we consider our own response to what Jesus has said to us this morning. Let's think about what Jesus has said about division because of him. Let's consider Jesus' words about discerning the approach of Judgment Day. Let's think about the debt that we owe to God.